Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There's never been a vote cast in my tenure here that's done as much to relieve the burdens or provide more security for middle-class working families in America than this one. This is probably the most important vote that every sitting member of the Senate will cast in their tenure here. And I'm just proud to have been a part of it. And I thank my colleagues for staying with us. And I wish Ted Kennedy were here with us today to enjoy this. Merry Christmas to everybody.
Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut. Senators are dispersing now after having passed sweeping health insurance reform legislation just hours ago. The bill is the biggest change in any social safety net legislation in decades, and yet it's been sharply criticized on the left for falling far short of health reform goals. Dr. Erwin Redliner, president of the Children's Health Fund, has been closely watching the ins and outs of health insurance reform as it's wound its way in and out and through the legislative process. He joins us now to give us his take on whether this bill and a companion measure passed by the House last month will be good for children. Good morning.
Good morning.
And by the way, a programming note, if you are wanting to listen to the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, we are broadcasting it this year on WQXR. So please stay to talk about health insurance reform. But if you want to listen to music, you can move your dial over to 105.9 FM.
You're not going to ask me to sing, are you?
Actually, for those who will stay tuned, we will have Dr. Erwin Redliner singing a Christmas carol before the segment's through.
The entire audience will sing, but okay.
So, good to talk to you again, Dr. Redliner. The Senate bill is broadening coverage to 30 million more people. It will outlaw denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions, but it doesn't contain a public option. So before we sort of launch into our discussion, I want to play a little clip of President Obama and what he had to say on this issue.
There are a couple of critical protections that we feel very confident are going to push costs down. Number one, the structure of this exchange. Essentially, again, going back to the model that Congress uses and federal workers use, the reason that Congress has pretty good rates, they get a pretty good deal, is they're part of a huge pool of millions of federal workers. And every insurance company out there wants that business. And so they've got to compete, and they've got to keep costs relatively low and quality relatively high in order to get that business. Now, if you or I just go to the private marketplace, we've got no leverage, and we don't get as good of a deal. The idea here is we're essentially setting up a ability for everybody in the nation to pool together and buy through this exchange. That's going to drive prices down. If insurance companies try to engage in obnoxious practices, they're not going to be able to compete.
And that was President Obama speaking last night on All Things Considered with NPR's Robert Siegel and Julie Rovner. Dr. Erwin Redliner, you have been critical of these exchanges, and in your statement this morning, you specifically expressed concern about them. How do you address what President Obama was saying?
Well, I think in principle, the exchanges are, you know, can be a good idea. And the whole idea is, the president was saying, is that the more people that are in the pool to be able to buy health insurance from a group of insurers who want to play in that market, the better control we'll have of prices and of quality. The problem might be, and I say might be, is if the program is such that it tends to attract only people with lots of high-risk conditions. For instance, if employers or other organizations that insure people somehow exclude people who have let's say, certain kinds of conditions, where it makes them more at risk and more vulnerable to health conditions, we could end up with the pool having sicker individuals and insurance companies not really complying with the guidelines to keep prices down, and we'll have to cover people who are sicker with higher rates. And the other problem is that if the bill says it's a national pool, the final bill, that is, that's good, because we'll have millions and millions of people involved. If some people have their way in Congress and it turns out to be a state-by-state pool, like the Senate is proposing right now, that will mean each state will have its own separate pool and far fewer people will be in it. That means far less bargaining power. So I say that the exchanges are fine. They could be great, but there are caveats that we just have to be careful about.
And how, I mean, specifically, do these exchanges affect children?
Well, right now, children who are living with low-income parents in families that are only making up to a certain low-middle-class wage have an opportunity to buy into the CHIP program, which everyone's familiar with, the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that has been in existence since 1997. It's very high quality, very comprehensive care, that it's extremely affordable. But the CHIP program will at some point get wound down. And if it doesn't get reauthorized, then people simply assume that we don't need CHIP anymore and families can simply enroll in the pools. Well, the insurance pools and the exchanges may have much higher co-payments for families, so that we could end up in a situation where a family might be paying between up to 2%, let's say, of the total medical costs for their children. They're paying that 2% out of pocket in an exchange that could go up to 5 to 35% out of pocket. So the cost differential for parents under the exchange program, if we don't take special precautions here, could be a much heavier burden for families than the CHIP program is.
So this the legislation that was passed by the Senate would actually take children out of CHIP programs and put them in the exchanges?
Eventually. And the one good thing that the Senate has insisted on, and that's a couple of senators have really kept people's feet to the fire, including Jay Rockefeller, but what the Senate bill is proposing is that CHIP remains in effect until 2019. The House bill, by the way, authorizes the CHIP program until 2015. But at that point, we'll have to really examine what happens to the CHIP program and will it be matched by what's offered to parents under the new legislation. But we have a few years' grace period where we can work out some of those kinks.
My guest is Dr. Erwin Redliner of the Children's Health Fund. We're talking about the health care bill that just passed the Senate hours ago, really. The number here at WNYC is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, and we'll take some of your questions for Dr. Erwin Redliner about the health care bill. What's in it? What's in it for children? What's in it for your family? And we'd like to know also what you think. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. As you know, the vote was strictly along partisan lines, 62-39. Dr. Redlin, are you still with us?
Yes.
So what, tell me what, you, one of the things that you were talking about in the bill was oral health, which was an interesting thing to me to single out, because I don't think that people have been talking about teeth for the course of this health care bill, and yet it was at the top of your list of things that you thought was good.
Well, you know, we have been providing health care to low-income children around the country since 1987, really, and over 2 million health care encounters. This is under the auspices of the Children's Health Fund. And one of the things that we've found over the years is that oral health problems, dental decay and other and abscesses and other things that can affect children in terms of their dental health is concerned, have overwhelming impacts on kids. Kids who have chronic and persistent problems with untreated oral health issues like decay.
Dr. Redliner, I have to interrupt you now because your phone line is degenerating. So we're going to take a couple of calls while we try to get you on a cleaner line. Let's go to Francis from Manhattan. Hi, Francis, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was calling basically because I found this bill to fall really short of what I expected when I voted for Obama. And I think that there was a really, really good chance that we could have gotten the public option through if we started at least with single payer. But I don't feel like we really had much of a negotiation. I think the Democrats caved really early on, in other words.
And yet, I mean, there certainly seemed some points over the course of the past year when it seemed like there would be no health care bill at all. And now you've just had the Senate vote to pass a health care reform bill. And I don't know if you heard the clip of President Obama earlier and whether that swayed your vote at all. I mean, it swayed your impression at all of what the vote was today.
What I don't understand, I mean, I don't need to not answer your question, but is why the press doesn't cover what the standard of medical care is in Western Europe and in most of the rest of the world, in a way where Americans can realize how much we're being screwed. You know, because, I mean, for us to be such a rich country and so far behind, and that not be something that's so clear to people, I mean, we didn't even have to reinvent the wheel. All we had to do is see what works around the world and maybe, you know, incorporate all the best of that, put it together. But there was never any of that in the media. There still isn't. You ask the average American, what is health care like in any detail in another country? They won't know.
All right, Francis, thanks very much for your call, and happy holidays to you. And we do have Dr. Redliner back. And I just wanted to ask you a question about the S-CHIP coverage before we begin to take some calls about how this bill will affect people specifically. S-CHIP is something that people seem really happy with. Essentially, what it does is put children in Medicaid, right, if I have that right?
Well, it's a separate program, but it's similar to.
So why is it something that this bill would undo? Why not just leave it as it is?
Well, first of all, the current bill, which was reauthorized, originally it was S-CHIP, passed in 97. It was reauthorized earlier this year by President Obama as just plain CHIP without the S on it. But it is set to expire in 5 years anyway. So it will either have to be reauthorized, or it will simply the principles of S-CHIP or CHIP will be absorbed into the new legislation. For simplicity's sake, we're trying to see if we can make the process as simple as possible with very direct access to health care. The thought is, will CHIP still be necessary when this current version expires in a few years? If it's not necessary because the benefits and the costs are similar under the new legislation, that'll be fine. We won't need it. What child advocates are concerned about is that the benefits might not be as generous as they are under CHIP, and the costs might be higher for families. So this is something that the children's health community is paying very close attention to, but that's what's behind the issue.
All right, let's take some questions for you. Carrie from South Bound Brook, New Jersey. Do you have a question for Dr. Erwin Redliner?
Yes, I do. I have a daughter who's 10 years old who has a form of schizophrenia, and I was wondering how this new health care bill is going to handle like severe mental illnesses that cost tremendous amounts of money and need specialists that don't participate in insurance and hospitalizations frequently.
Dr. Redliner?
This is a great question, and this is something that's been a real problem for health providers and families for a number of years now, which is the lack of so-called parity between mental health conditions and physical health conditions. And we think that both versions of the bill, the House and the Senate, will provide the parity that has been really necessary in insurance programs in the past. And I think we're finally going to see some light at the end of the tunnel here. But the basic point that you're making is that children who have significant or any kind of mental health, behavioral, emotional problems should be getting the same kind of attention and support in terms of what's covered as do children with physical ailments. So we're with you, and we're going to be watching how that turns out very closely as well.
Thanks for your call, Carrie. Let's take another question from Nora from Westchester. Hi, Nora. You're on WNYC.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with young adults who have graduated high school or college but don't have a job yet that will cover them. How will this affect them?
This is another very good question. It's been a big concern, too. But fortunately, both bills in the House and the Senate will allow people to remain on Medicaid until they're 26 years of age, if they're on Medicaid. And they also, if their parents have insurance, which they will undoubtedly in greater numbers after this bill is passed, they'll be able to be part of their parents' plans until they're 26 as well. So I think that problem, which happened in the Redliner family as well, will be solved by allowing young people to remain on the parents' plans.
Thanks for your call, Nora. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking about the health care bill that just passed the United States Senate this morning with Dr. Erwin Redliner. He's a child health advocate, longtime child health advocate, and president of the Children's Health Fund. Dr. Redliner, tell me, you know, sort of looking at things a year ago, Would you have predicted that this play out the way it has?
A year ago, I think all of us who have been in the trenches around health reform for literally decades now were hopeful but uncertain about what would actually happen. I mean, so much resistance. Don't forget, we've been fighting this battle, not me personally, but people have been fighting for health reform since Harry Truman's day. So we're talking about well over 60 years of this battle. So I think there was a great deal of optimism with the election of Barack Obama to the White House, but I think there was also a certain amount of caution that, that people were sensing too, that we don't want to get our expectations too high. But at the end of the day, I think there was a lot of optimism that Barack Obama's election and the prevailing of Democrats in the Congress would in fact yield finally this kind of outcome, which is really being on the verge now of getting major national reform passed.
So you feel that it's close to as good as it could have been, given the political circumstances? Could it have been better?
This is a very difficult question. I think people that are very involved in healthcare reform, and especially the more progressive advocates for, let's say, single payer or Canadian style health reform or Medicare for all, have been disappointed about the so-called debate, and may be disappointed with the outcome because it's certainly not perfect on many different levels. My own personal feeling is that this is a tremendous opportunity that may not come around again for a very long time. So I'm very happy about the what seems to be an outcome that advances healthcare to the point where 30 million people or more will now be covered who weren't covered before, and that some of the more egregious, horrific practices that insurance companies have been foisting on us over the last couple of decades will be eliminated. Those two things alone, the insurance rules and increasing the number of people who are insured, make this something that we need to be celebratory about. And I think I'm looking forward to the final outcome.
All right, let's take another call on health insurance reform. Dana from Wilton, Connecticut. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Oh, good morning. My question is as follows. I just wanted to know, is there anything in this bill that is going to encourage doctors to take insurance? I live in Fairfield County. I have a private insurance plan. None of my doctors take my insurance. None of the doctors I go to take any insurance at all. And this is the thing that worries me. Are we selling people a bill of goods?
Dr. Redliner?
Yeah, this is a big problem and a very important one as far as I'm concerned, and that there are certain things that the bill does not address at all in terms of the quality of practice. Where are doctors actually practicing? What is the requirement for doctors to take people's insurance? And a lot of these issues are just not sufficiently addressed. Some are addressed a little bit, and some are not addressed at all. But as far as the taking insurance is concerned, I think the practice of many physicians who don't want to deal with the paperwork, which is pretty onerous because many people come in with many, many different plans, or they're not getting paid enough in their opinion, or whatever the case might be. And I don't want to we could discuss that if you want to. But the end of the day is that you people end up having to pay out of pocket and then going to their insurance companies to get reimbursed for some percentage of what they actually paid. It's a really bad part of the way the current system is working. And I hope that's on the list of things that we have to continue to work on over time, even after this bill is passed.
When we, in 20 years from now, Dr. Redliner, when you and I are 45, will we look back and say that this was a sort of landmark moment for children's health in this country?
I think this is going to be a historic piece of legislation and a landmark for children and families. And there's no question about that. In spite of all the carping from the right and from the left, I think what we have basically is a mainstream, massive, a mainstream bill that has going to have massive impact on a lot of Americans and will really affect positively the way people get their health care. Could it be better? Of course it could be. It might get better in the future. I'm sure it will. And I'm sure some of the provisions will turn out to be not so effective or not so cost effective or even providing the quality that we want. So there'll be a long agenda of things that have to be worked on as we go forward. But yes, this will be historic. This will really help children and families, and I think we're looking forward to some significant revisions in a system which is really exceedingly dysfunctional. I can't emphasize enough how bad the current so-called system is, and that's why this is more than a breath of fresh air. This is real important improvements in the quality and the effectiveness of healthcare in America.
We have a question from our chat page, comment page on the Brian Lehrer page on WNYC.org. Eric from Pennsylvania is asking, what does this bill do for middle-aged, middle-class people, especially with kids, who are independently employed, and when do any applicable provisions kick in?
Another very good question. So for people that are independently employed right now, and so that therefore they do not have an employer providing health insurance, those individuals will be able to be part of these health insurance exchanges or large pools. So millions of people who are in similar conditions will band together, and because they're pooled together, will have very significant bargaining ability with insurance companies. So insurance companies will want to participate in the pools, meaning they'll have to comply with certain levels of cost ceilings. In other words, the cost won't be able to go above a certain level. They'll have to give data allowing people to compare various insurance programs, and they'll have to have a basic level of services provided. So an individual such as the gentleman you're talking about will be able to join the pool and get insurance as if he or she was in a massive organization that was negotiating hard with insurance companies to get the best possible deal.
Let's take another call. Sebastian from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on WNYC with Dr. Erwin Redliner.
Hi, my question is about, I understand that in the bill, people will not be able to be denied health insurance for having pre-existing conditions. So my question is, just because they will not be denied health insurance for pre-existing conditions, does that mean that they will necessarily be covered fully for every particular instance of healthcare treatment? Meaning, like right now, just because someone has health insurance, let's say I'm on Aetna, it doesn't mean I'm going to go in and no matter what my doctor gives me, that's going to be fully covered. So are people still going to be fully covered for everything, or is it just that they're going to generally have health insurance, which might not cover them for every instance of treatment?
Dr. Redliner?
Well, in theory, people will be covered for the essentials of what they need for whatever their condition is, and people will not be able to be denied coverage. Where this gets murky, Sebastian, and this is it's a very good question, is let's say there's a new treatment out that is looking pretty good but not completely approved yet, or it hasn't reached the insurance industry or the provider, even the physicians who are providing services in terms of being well established. The question is, will that be covered? If the protocols change so that people are followed up, let's say you have a malignancy and they're supposed to be getting CT scans, let's say every year, and then new data comes out and says, well, it would be better to get a CT scan every 3 months. Will that be covered? Those nuances will have to be worked out, and the only way that we're going to be able to do that effectively is to have groups of experts who will help evaluate new treatments and make determinations about whether they should not be included in the coverage that people have. But I think there's more to come on that, and that's, again, one of those things that we're going to have to work out over time once the bill gets passed.
The question, though, let me just sort of pile on to Sebastian's question about not just pre-existing conditions and new treatments, but what happens when, can your insurance company say we're covering this but not that? Like if you get sick with some disease, we're not covering it under the policy that you have.
Well, it depends as the details get worked out for the final bill. And by the way, just a reminder that we don't actually have a final bill yet. We have a Senate and a House version that are going to have to be melded in this conference process, and then a lot more details will come forward. But to your point, I think there's going to be a lot of negotiation among, let's say, physician specialty organizations and insurance companies, with the government mediating this to determine what actually should be covered in a person's particular insurance product. So I think a lot of that remains to be seen, and we don't actually know the answer at this point to those very detailed questions like that. And even though the bill's around 2,000 pages long, we have some work to do on figuring out exactly how it's going to affect people with existing, pre-existing conditions or new conditions that they develop. But I think the effort to control egregious practices by insurance companies will say, for instance, that there can be no lifetime limit on the amount of coverage that you get or the amount of reimbursement that people get. There could be no annual limits on that reimbursement. So there will be lots of leverage on the insurance companies, but we'll have to see how far that's actually going to go.
Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. My guest is Dr. Erwin Redliner, president of the Children's Health Fund. We've been talking about the Senate passage this morning of the health care bill. As it happens, Dr. Redliner, you're also the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness. So I just wanted to take a couple minutes to talk about swine flu.
Sure.
This week we've been reading about more recalls of the nasal version of the vaccine. Should parents be worried about that?
I don't think parents need to be worried about that. It has to do with a loss of efficacy after a certain amount of time. But virtually, well, let's say almost every person that got that the nasal version of the vaccine got it during a time when the vaccine was perfectly efficacious. So in other words, I don't think that's a worry anymore. It's a worry going forward. But I don't think we'll have a problem going forward because we now have plenty of the regular vaccine to go around, and I just don't think it's going to be an issue.
How effective has the vaccination program been for children?
It's been, I would say, moderately effective in that lots of children have gotten vaccinated. Many parents decided to withhold the vaccine for their kids. And in the beginning, of course, we had a real problem with the supply and distribution of vaccines. So we ended up the season with a fair number of children being vaccinated, but millions of children did not receive the vaccine. I think we have work to do on our vaccination protocols and our manufacturing process because we really got caught short in the fall here with far too few doses available to the public and some real problems in distribution of it. Although all those issues are now resolved, we're pretty well deeply into the flu season. But fortunately, the incidence of H1N1 seems to be dropping rapidly, so that there's only a few states now left with ongoing significant problems in with the number of people with H1N1.
Do you think the city of New York did enough for middle and high school age children? After all, the vaccine wasn't offered in their schools. It was offered at these centers, and there weren't that many of them.
The process for distributing and administering the vaccine in New York City, in fact, throughout the state, as well as really around the country, is going to have to be reexamined now as part of the after-action report about how we did here. You know, if you look across the country, New York City included, there are many different ways that officials distributed the vaccine. In Los Angeles, for instance, you literally could only get the vaccine in a public health clinic. No doctor's offices had it, no schools had it. And for a long time, that was really a barrier to getting rapid uptake of the vaccine. New York City's program was at best moderately successful, and we're going to have to reexamine that also in terms of being ready for the next time we need to do mass inoculations. But I think we did a pretty good job, and I think there's room to learn for the next round.
So looking back over the past year, how would you rate both the severity of the pandemic, severe, more severe than we thought, and the public health response?
First of all, the pandemic itself was relatively mild because the fatality rate was far less than it could have been. And the benchmark, of course, for this is the famous Spanish flu of 1918, where 50 million or more people were died of the disease worldwide. And the deaths in this particular situation worldwide were under 50,000. So we're talking about worlds of difference in the consequences. What I am concerned about, though, is that the situation that we dealt with over this last, let's say, 6 months has revealed several gaps in our ability to respond effectively to a large-scale and more serious pandemic, both on the public health side, including the manufacturing process and the distribution of vaccine, as well as how ready our hospitals might have been to a severe pandemic. And unfortunately, the hospital system in New York and around the country was not in the slightest bit ready for a massive pandemic. And that is something we're going to have to pay attention to, because the next time we may not be so lucky. We got a very serious situation, and we'll find our healthcare system really not quite ready to deal with the consequences.
Thank you so much. Dr. Erwin Redlener is the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness and the president of the Children's Health Fund. It's always great to talk to you.
Likewise, Andrea. Thank you very much. And that National Center, of course, is at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. We'll speak again. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks to everyone who called. When we come up, last-minute holiday entertaining tips and an update on what's going on with Acorn.